Into the Fold is a podcast on mental health issues, produced by the Haug Foundation for Mental Health. The Haug Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. Hi, welcome to Into the Fold, a podcast on mental health issues. I'm your host, Ike Evans, and today we are coming to you from the Central Texas African American Family Support Conference in Austin, Texas. This year's event is significant for two reasons. First, it is the 20th anniversary of the Central Texas African American Family Support Conference. Started in November 2000, the conference was the first in Texas and only the third in the United States to focus on the healthcare needs of African Americans. And second, it overlaps with the 80th anniversary of the founding of the Haug Foundation for Mental Health, which has been integrally involved with the conference throughout its history and is a gold sponsor of this year's event. The Central Texas African American Family Support Conference was born from a desire to confront the systems and cultural bias that have resulted in African Americans facing barriers to healthcare access. For this episode of the podcast, we will be talking to two scholars with urgent thoughts to share on both the past and present of mental health and its connection to health equity, particularly in the case of African Americans. And as a bonus, I'll be introducing you to the very first awardees of the new Healthy Minds Grants. Our first interview is with Dr. King Davis. King Davis is a professor of research in the School of Information at the University of Texas at Austin. He is the principal investigator for the groundbreaking Digital Archives Project, focused on the archives from the Central Lunatic Asylum for Colored Insane, America's first asylum for blacks in the United States. He was the inaugural director of the Texas Institute for Urban Policy Research and Analysis, and also served as executive director of the Haug Foundation for Mental Health from 2003 to 2008. He is fresh off of delivering this morning's keynote address at this year's Central Texas African American Family Support Conference. Dr. King Davis, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
The title of your address was Historical Solutions to the Problems Minorities Face. So I hope this question isn't too tongue-in-cheek. What typifies an historical solution versus any other kind?
I think that's probably a reflection of the way that it was phrased for the conference. And what is probably more accurate would be to suggest that there have been a series of historical events, the historiography of issues of race and mental illness in the United States, for which there are some possible solutions so that we don't replicate history.
And so you gave us an overview of your work as principal investigator for the Central State Hospital Archives Project, and then more recently given a grant by the Haug Foundation for our own state hospital archives project. So maybe you could just like start with, for our listeners, kind of start with an overview of the Central State project and then sort of transition to the new project, like how they're alike, how they're different in scope, and what it is that you're hoping to accomplish.
Let's start in part with a piece of the last point that you raised. What, in my interpretation, why are we doing this? And in part, it's to try to make sure as much as possible that we learn from the history of psychiatry, the history of psychiatric treatment, admissions, and the extent to which some of these kinds of treatments or approaches reflect issues of race, class, gender, and the like. So at Central State, part of what we were interested in and part of the reason that we got involved in this project was that this was the first mental institution created exclusively for newly freed slaves in the United States. And whenever I say that, part of what it raises for me is we're only talking about persons being admitted to this hospital just a few short years after they were released from servitude. So how that was done, that is the admissions process, the diagnoses, the treatment, the care, things of that sort, are of real importance, it seems to me, in terms of understanding the history. So part of what Centro had that is not available in any other setting are about 800,000 of their original documents. Those documents were started in terms of their development around 1864, and they continue to this very day, although we don't have access to all of those. And so our task as persons from the UT School of Information was to first identify the range of items within their collection. Same thing that we'll do at Ash. How many, what types, are there different categories of materials that are available? And once identified, we categorize those materials. Every piece of the 800,000 documents has a number, an identifying number, so that we can follow where the items are and to some extent what they are. We'll do the same at Ash. Part of what we also do with those, and we did at Central State, was to create what we call a finding aid, a method that our archivist creates so that at any time, any place, we know what's in which box so that we can find it and utilize it again. So that's sort of the first one or two or three parts that are there. The next step in the process, both at Central, where we actually started this, and then at Ash, will be to digitize, that is, copy every one of their paper documents, every one of their 10,000 photographs, and we'll also probably find that there are some negatives or even slides available. Once we do that, we will return the documents as we have to Central State, we'll return the documents to Ash, and we'll engage with the staff at both institutions how to interpret the materials, how to find the materials, how to make use of the materials. The one area that's likely to be different, at least at the beginning between Central and Ash, is that we entered 30,000 names into the Central State Excel database. 30,000 names of the first 30,000 persons admitted to the hospital between 1870 to 1941. 1941 is the stop date because of state law. We have not worked with or talked with the folks at Hogg or at the hospital whether or not they have an interest or whether there's somebody locally that they might want to get to enter data on every individual person admitted. At Central, we have 32 characteristics of every person admitted. Where they lived, where they were born, whether they have children, whether they were married, what their occupations were, when they were admitted, just lots of extraordinary data, which allows us to make some statistical kinds of decisions about the persons and whether or not some of those 32 characteristics are related to what I call the risk of admission. So that's parallel scopes.
And you had quite a bit to say about the emotional response that you had and are still having to what it is that you've been able to uncover in these records. And so one thing that I'm wondering is, you know, if you have any examples of the things that are in these records that really come alive for you, you know, that all the agglomerations of data that, you know, that people who work in public health normally deal with doesn't fully capture.
The first thing that I think affected me most came several years ago, and that was when we identified in the literature that the psychiatrist director of Eastern State Hospital, the first one in the United States, and the second one developed in the United States, Dr. Francis Stribling, reached a decision that Africans, enslaved Africans, were immune from mental illness. There was no risk. And part of the reason for that, going back for way back into the 1700s, was this notion that mental illness really was a lack of reason, that a person had lost their ability to reason. And the governor at that time, along with these two state hospital directors, decided that African people were immune from this because our people lacked the ability to reason. And that was very painful for me. It really then meant that regardless of the behavioral manifestations that people of African descent displayed, they were not going to get any mental health care. The directors at that time period proposed that the only people who were likely to develop mental health problems were people who had responsibility for business, slavery didn't count, or people who were in civic affairs, slaves didn't have the vote, and thus they were free, that is the slaves, of any kind of situational stresses that would cause mental illness. That was very painful for me. After the 1840 census was issued, all of that started to change. But my emotional reactions to it were as strong as they ever were, because in order to justify the continuation of slavery, it was suggested that, aha, black people will not be able to deal with freedom, and they will develop even higher rates of mental illness. They'll be violent. They'll be alcoholics. They'll be drug addicts. They'll be violent. They'll be slovenly. It was, again, extraordinarily painful. And it raised for me these questions about the perception of the relationship between blackness and pathology. And it's very painful. And then I traced that all the way up through the 1960s, the 70s, and I didn't mention in today's presentation, up into the 90s, because we also have data, rarely spoken about, of black admissions from 1970 to 2000. So I can continue to find and process these kinds of micro and what I would even call macro insults that are extraordinarily painful. When I read individual records about families looking for their relatives, not being able to find them, it hurts a lot. It hurts in part because of the violation of the disregard of professional ethics or the dehumanization of people of African descent that you find in the historical records.
We hear quite a bit nowadays about the intersections between mental health and other kinds of disadvantage. Mm-hmm. But even for those of us who consider ourselves fairly sophisticated, are there ways that a certain way of engaging with these records can complexify yet further our how we think about mental health, how we talk about mental health, that spring to mind for you?
Once all of the data, the 9 million bits of information that we have about the first 30,000 people are statistically correlated, I think most of our earlier questions will have plausible answers. I'll be able to tell you that if you are from Suffolk, Virginia, your chances of being admitted to Central are pretty damn good, much greater than if you were from Hanover County. I'll be able to tell you that if you are male and married, your chances of getting married are better than they are for black women. I'll be able to tell you that if you are in a lower wage occupation, your chances of being admitted to the hospital with a serious mental illness diagnosis are greater than they are if you're a school teacher. So yes, there are lots of things that by getting into the guts of this data will answer a lot of questions for us, not only about geography and risk, but lots and lots of others as well. A number of the people who were admitted to this hospital after 3, 5, 7 years were found not to have been insane, as it was called. So why were they there? There were people who died in the hospital. Nobody knows where they were buried. There are people who were admitted to the hospital and their families didn't know that they were there for many, many, many years. There are families today, some people in the audience in this conference that I know, whose relatives were at that hospital. And they want more information about the diagnosis, about the treatment. And so I think the data from this hospital offers family members, not just scholars, but family members, information that could, in fact, help those families to deal with some of the issues of those relatives that may have either disappeared or whose behavior was odd and unusual for them.
Okay, Dr. King Davis, he is the former executive director of the Hawk Foundation for Mental Health, now currently, among numerous other projects, heading up the digitization of patient records at Austin State Hospital, We are coming at you from the Central Texas African American Family Support Conference. Apologies for any background noise or murmurings that you might hear as we had this conversation. Dr. Davis, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
As part of the Hogg Foundation's 80th anniversary and the Central Texas African American Family Support Conference's 20th anniversary, the Hogg Foundation launched the Central Texas African American Healthy Minds Project. The foundation invested $20,000 in one-time grant awards to support mental health and wellness among African Americans in the Central Texas area. In February of 2020, we selected 8 organizations, 4 projects focusing on adults aged 18 and over, and 4 focusing on youth to receive one-year grants in the amount of $2,500 each. We're always proud of the work of our grantees, new and old. So here they are, the first ever Healthy Minds Grant awardees, starting with the adult projects. Austin Area Mental Health Consumers is providing direct, one-to-one peer services and community awareness activities and events to educate African Americans on mental health, wellness resources, and recovery. Austin Area Urban League is hosting community forums, focus groups, presentations to open conversations about community needs and resources to support mental health, stress, and wellness of African Americans in the Austin area. National Alliance on Mental Illness Texas is offering no-cost, peer-led programs, including the Family and Friends Workshop and Bridges to Hope training for faith leaders with David's Chapel. Sickle Cell Association of Texas is conducting monthly in-person support groups to foster mental health, peer support, ongoing case management to support holistic care for individuals living with sickle cell and their families. And now for the youth projects. Building Promises is launching the A Cut Above initiative designed for Black and Brown middle school boys ages 11 through 15 from low-income neighborhoods. The program is enhanced by restorative practices that strengthen interpersonal communication, builds a caring community of learners, and improves self-efficacy. Excellence and Advancement Foundation, in partnership with the You're Not Alone Fellowship, is focusing on education about suicide prevention through presentations, workshops, and wellness opportunities for students at Houston-Tillotson University and Austin-area African-American teens. God's Way Christian Fellowship is educating African-American youth in rural Williamson County and their families on the impact of poverty and how to recognize signs and symptoms of trauma, develop coping mechanisms, and promote resiliency. What's in the Mirror is launching the Without Color Project, which will provide awareness and education to parents, educators, and healthcare providers on the condition of albinism, as well as provide mentorship and supports around mental health for African American youth with albinism. Congratulations to all of the awardees, and we look forward to each of you accomplishing great things over the next year. Our next interview is with Dr. Altha Stewart. Altha J. Stewart is Senior Associate Dean for Community Health Engagement for the University of Tennessee Health Science Center in Memphis. In 2018, she served as President of the American Psychiatric Association, the first African American elected this position in the 175-year history of the organization. A native of Memphis, Dr. Stewart has worked for decades as CEO, Executive Director in large public mental health systems in Pennsylvania, New York, and Michigan. Among other accolades, she is the recipient of the Memphis Child Advocacy Center Community Advocate Award and the Black Psychiatrist of America Lifetime Achievement Award. She is here with us at the Central Texas African American Family Support Conference. Dr. Altha Stewart, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
So my first question is that in your keynote, you were quite explicit about defining health equity as a matter of social justice. So do you see challenges in mobilizing people around an issue like that that doesn't seem to have an easily identifiable villain?
Well, no, I guess is the direct answer to the question. No, I don't see insurmountable challenge to that. I think there are many identifiable villains in the creation of a healthcare system that is inadequate to meet the needs of the people who most need it, that by its very structure is designed to not have maximum access for the people who are most needy, chronically ill, whether it's medical or psychiatric. And I think the other part of the villain contingent is the people who currently run the system and have no thought about changing that to better accommodate the needs of most people. And this is not just poor and minority people. This is anyone who cannot afford the cost of health care is not being well served by our current system. So there are plenty of villains, and I think the social justice nature of it commands us as citizens, public servants, if you will, to really take it upon ourselves to organize in ways that allow us to see this as the marathon that it is, that we address those pieces of the system that we can readily address and that we strategically plan to address those others as we gain more knowledge and are better educated about where some of the challenges are.
So one thing that I've always wondered is if there are any examples of research models that are kind of uniquely suited to addressing the problem of health equity, and that can even yield results that kind of stand above like the huge agglomerations of data that we already have within the public health space.
I think the most appropriate model for achieving health or mental health equity, for that matter, is a community-based research model, because it is not going to be designed solely by people who work in universities or academic settings. It has to incorporate the ideas and thoughts and needs of the population being served. Thus, the community-based model makes the most sense in trying to achieve some understanding of the issues and some way to most effectively and efficiently utilize all the data that we have. I mean, you don't have to go far to find the research to demonstrate in mental health, for example, that people, particularly people of color, come into the system when they are farther along in the development of the illness, when the symptoms and the manifestation of those symptoms are creating more serious problems, when the level of intensity of the treatment that is needed is more costly, more restrictive, and more challenging on many levels. That research is done, and done. The data is there, and what's missing, I think, is how we translate that data that is there, that documents what people believe and what is in fact true, and translates that into effective models of care that address the real needs of folks and that encourage people to use it because it's designed in a way to allow them maximum access and ease of entry. There are models out there where communities have gathered. They've created the front door, the front porch, if you will, for getting populations in who historically have not warmed to health or mental health, who are working hard to dispel myths. We talk a lot about the Tuskegee experiments, and that's why people aren't willing to trust the medical establishment. But there are more recent and more local, close-to-home experiences that people have just in going to a doctor's office or a clinic or the local hospital that compel them, even if they knew nothing about Tuskegee, to never want to go back there again. And that means they're missing out on high-quality care, They're missing out on the education that comes when you have a relationship with a healthcare provider, and they're missing out on the opportunity to live a healthy, productive life without the manifestations of chronic medical problems. These are things that I think we can do something about. These are things that communities organized and educated can definitely do something about. I work in communities where people tell me all the time, look, we've been dealing with this problem long before you folks from the university came. So if you think you've got the magic bullet that's going to answer all the questions, you're wrong. We have some ideas on how to achieve both of our goals about, in my case, working with the kids in the juvenile justice system, how to reduce the number of children who go into that system using some well-known, tested, effective methods for intervening early, getting upstream. But if the people in the institutions that come up with these great models aren't aware of how folks on the ground actually use what they've learned through their experience, and that doesn't get integrated, then we've got one side saying this will work if you just give it a chance, and the other side saying, nah, not going to work. And you know why? Because we're not going to do it. It makes a difference when communities are at the table.
So I work for the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health, and so I think it's appropriate that my next question be, in what ways is mental health kind of uniquely promising as a potential leverage point for, you know, for moving the needle on health equity? I mean, of all issues that one could choose.
Well, as a psychiatrist, I'm always pleased when I hear people say that they think mental health could actually be the driver in this goal of achieving health equity. And I would submit that I agree with that statement. I think to be in the best frame of health, one has to have the best possible health and well-being as it relates to emotional and psychological well-being. The issue, I think, is that the bad rap that mental health has with respect to stigma and discrimination against people with mental illness and fears and myths about people with mental illness and what will happen has prevented people from seeing that in truth there is no health without mental health. People are much more likely to follow medical health treatment regimens if they are psychologically predisposed, if they have the supports and the strengths psychologically to understand the importance and to follow the ways we change behaviors to improve health, those people who are most psychologically and positively inclined psychologically are much better at complying with treatment plans for hypertension, diabetes, obesity, and a host of other medical problems. People also don't realize that for many of the chronic medical problems, again, those that primarily or are highly prevalent in people of color, diabetes, hypertension, cardiovascular illnesses, cancer, renal disease, these are medical problems that travel, I like to say, with psychological companions. People with cancer are often depressed. People with diabetes who are having challenges with their managing their blood glucose often get depressed. People who have cardiovascular illness are always anxious about the next event. So whether we like to think of it or not, most people with a medical problem are more likely and more at risk for developing some psychological distress problem, which would benefit from mental health treatment. If we're going to actually get to mental health equity and reduce disparities, we have got to address those psychological issues that prevent people from being good at maintaining good health.
So I talk to academics, people in academia, who are well-versed on the language of health equity often enough that it's sometimes a challenge for me to not view their standpoints as fully interchangeable. You know, you take a segment from person A, another from person B, and another from person C, and pretty much regardless of the order that you put them in, it all pretty much amounts to the same basic argument. So this is a question that I think that I'm going to start asking people a little bit more often. And that is, what, in your opinion, do people really need to get about you so that they fully understand where it is that you are coming from and the change that you are trying to make happen?
You know, that's a favorite. That's going to be my next favorite question, because I think what people need to accept about me is that I speak about this because I'm passionate about this work and because I truly believe that it is both our responsibility as human beings and responsible citizens to make this work, to create an equitable system so that whether it's my child or someone else's child, that it helps them, whether it's my family member or someone else's family member, that they have access, and whether it's the place where I work or the place down the street, that we all pay attention and attend to the needs of the people who come through, except the fact that one size does not fit all, and that in a very real sense, when it comes to health, race matters. And to ignore any of those things in an effort to, you know, have one bubble where everybody fits into it is to deny people what they really need. And I have real challenges accepting that we can't do better in healthcare.
She is Dr. Altha Stewart, joining us here in Austin at the Central Texas African American Family Support Conference. We're very happy that she was able to find the time in her busy schedule to talk to us, to talk to our podcast, and to share her perspective on the interrelations between mental health, health equity, and just about anything that a person or community would ever want to achieve. So we really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's been my pleasure.
This is not our first dive into the Central State Hospital Archives Project. In episodes 11 and 26, I interviewed respectively Dr. Patricia Galloway, Professor of Digital Archiving in the School of Information at the University of Texas at Austin, and Dr. King Davis about the project. I have included links to both episodes in the episode description. They provide a wealth of information and additional historical context about the project. Do find the time to check those out. We hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can find related resources for this conversation in the episode description. Please leave us a review and subscribe to us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, or TuneIn. Thank you very much.